You're listening to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Until recently, if I were to name the top factors that distinguish Boston and New York City, off the top of my head, I might have said, the accent, the sports teams, you know, Red Sox versus Yankees, the chowder. But that was then. I now have something else to point to. Research, published in April, found that Boston and New York are home to two genetically distinct populations of pigeons. They do not mix.
The pigeons have their own idea of what these cities look like, when obviously we as people really do too. It's just our ideas are kind of a little bit different from the way that a pigeon sees it.
That's Joshua Sokol. He's a freelance writer covering natural history. He wrote a story for the New York Times, which is how we found out that the data says that there are two pigeon megacities in the Northeast, one covering New York and the Mid-Atlantic, the other covering Boston and Providence. And they're separated by Connecticut.
The theory, at least in the paper, is that this is just like a moat that they can't cross. Connecticut is.
Connecticut. What is it about Connecticut that keeps these two pigeon megalopolies separated? To understand, you've got to open up a whole conversation about how different organisms are adapting to cities, a field called urban evolution. We sent our producer Justine Paradise to call up the scientist behind the research.
When she arrives in a new city, one of the first things that Elizabeth Carlin does is stop at the local Starbucks, but not just for the coffee.
As I'm getting my coffee, I would say, hey, I have a really weird question. I am trying to figure out where pigeons are in this city. I study urban evolution. Do you know where the pigeons are? Where have you seen pigeons?
Elizabeth Carlin is a pigeon scientist. Well, more accurately,
I would call myself an urban evolutionary biologist and ecologist. It's kind of a broad term. Ecology and evolution are incredibly intertwined.
She's a PhD candidate at Fordham University. And she studies how cities are shaping evolution, specifically right now, the evolution of pigeons. Her lab at Fordham also studies coyotes, rats, and salamanders. And when she got there, she was like, we're missing a bird. And what better bird than a pigeon?
Considering humans have been living alongside pigeons for 5,000 to 10,000 years, how do we not know what their populations look like? Do we not understand how these populations are genetically structured?
When Elizabeth started her dissertation, the question was, do pigeons in the Northeast stick to one city, or do they disperse? But to figure this out, she had to find and catch a lot of birds. And this brings us back to Starbucks, where Elizabeth was asking everyone in line for coffee, where are your pigeons? No, but really, where are they specifically?
Pigeons are not everywhere in a city. I spent a lot of hours driving around cities and not seeing pigeons. And one of the things that I realized was we notice where pigeons are, but we tend to not notice where pigeons are not.
Once she managed to locate a pigeon flock, she would scatter some food on the ground nearby to lure them together. And then she would set up her net gun.
It's a CO2-powered contraption tool that shoots out a net that's about 6 feet by 6 feet over a group of pigeons.
And was that successful? Like, how did that go?
It is. I would catch anywhere from 0 up to 16 pigeons. So I do say, like, I would miss sometimes, but other times, you know, I would get a really good sample size from that area. And because the pigeons were kind of caught in that net, I could then get them out pretty quickly. And they would each individually go into a Whole Foods paper bag that was then sealed with a binder clip. And that way I could process each one, each bird individually.
So you would have like a pigeon in a bag?
Pigeon in a bag, yeah. And, you know, it kind of just looked like bags of groceries sitting out next to me on the street. You couldn't quite tell what was in there. The pigeons are pretty calm once they're in the bag. And I even had people come up to me and be like, hey, are you giving out food donations? And had to say to them, no, I don't think you want what's in here. I don't think you want to eat a city pigeon.
And as Elizabeth was collecting DNA samples and banding the birds, she'd get up really close to the pigeons. I'd notice a lot of details and variation.
They're beautiful birds, actually. The way that they fly, if you watch them fly and kind of navigate, it's really gorgeous. And the colors are quite amazing. So you can kind of think of your standard pigeon as that gray pigeon with the two bars on the wing, and that's referred to as a blue bar. But then they have this very gorgeous iridescent crop that's kind of purple and green.
Every time you see a city pigeon in the United States, you should know that bird is descended from an escaped pet or farm animal. That's why they're called feral pigeons. Pigeons were originally brought to North America as a food source by European colonizers. But they were also bred for their homing and racing abilities, and just like dogs or cats, for other fancy traits. And some of those specially bred pigeons have escaped, and their traits pop up in the feral population too.
Sometimes you'll see all black pigeons or all white pigeons or pigeons that are like a reddish brown. There'll be pigeons that are checkered colored. And if you get really close, you can see that some of them actually have feathered feet. Some of them have different colored toenails.
As you were like conducting the research and, you know, getting pigeon samples in the middle of cities, like, how did people respond to seeing this activity?
A lot of people, well, New Yorkers are kind of like, whatever, do your own thing. It's probably not even the weirdest thing that they saw that day in New York. And I always thought it was really important. I'm a guest in this neighborhood. Wherever I am, I'm a guest. And so it's really important that I invite people to come and experience this with me if they're interested. I had, at one point, a mom in Philadelphia, I was catching some pigeons in a parking lot, and her kids saw me. And she came out and she's like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "Oh, I'm just an urban scientist. I study pigeons." She's like, "Yeah, my kids thought it was really weird." And I was like, "Oh, do they want to come watch what I'm doing? I can hold off on collecting my data until they're here." And so she's like, "Yeah, they'd be so into that." She awesome. Went and got her kids and got some chairs out of the back of her car, some folding chairs. And we set up like a little semicircle classroom in this parking lot and had an impromptu science lesson. And the kids helped me weigh the birds and record the data and band the birds and then release them back out into the wild once I had taken the blood sample.
I was just thinking that I guess someone in a city like wouldn't have really see ecological research, but then I was like, wait, actually, I feel like it doesn't matter where you live. Most people just don't see research and how it's done.
Right. And there's this kind of misconception about what a scientist looks like. Are we in the lab all the time in our white coat with our goggles on? And that's not what I look like most of the time.
So Elizabeth, with the help of the neighborhood, collected her samples, banded and released the birds, and then back in the lab, she would sequence the DNA and crunch the data. And she thought that she'd find that each city would have its own pigeon population.
Because if they have food, if they have mates, and if they have shelter, there's no real reason to leave or disperse. So I thought that what I would see is that New York would have a different population from Philadelphia, which would have a different population from Baltimore, which would have a different population from DC. And that's not at all what I found.
Instead, her data told her that pigeons exist in a megacity, interbreeding in a huge collective population from New York to Washington, DC. Except, again, notably, in the case of the New England pigeons, the Boston-Providence population. That population did not interbreed with pigeons in New York and the rest of the Eastern Seaboard.
That was like, okay, what's going on here? This is a huge kind of area from New York all the way down to DC. That's a huge area for pigeons to consider like a single city. And then why were the Boston pigeons kind of falling out as a separate population?
So Elizabeth started to try to figure it out.
Normally we use, as urban evolutionary biologists, we use impervious surface maps to kind of look at where cities are.
An impervious surface is anything water can't easily soak into, like asphalt, concrete, or surfaces on buildings. But when Elizabeth charted her data on this map, it didn't quite line up.
And so the next thing that I looked at was this map of the East Coast at night with all the urban areas kind of highlighted, because we have so much light pollution in the Northeast that it's actually very bright at night. And what I found was that this light is almost continuous from New York down to Washington, D.C. There's a weird break in Connecticut. And then again, it's very bright around Boston and Providence.
Which did match her data. So what does this tell us? For starters, what we already know, it tells us pigeons are urban birds. They thrive in cities and not in green spaces. Green spaces like suburban Connecticut, which is an odd thing in itself. But it also tells us something else. Our idea of what counts as a city or what counts as urban might be very different than what a pigeon considers urban.
One of the biggest questions right now in our field is, how do we define urbanization? Are there different metrics that we should be using? Because in a lot of cases, cities might look the same in terms of built-up space, but have a different number of people living in those cities. So someplace like New York versus St. Louis, we can say, yes, those are both very urban places, but obviously New York builds up and St. Louis builds out. And so the urbanization in these two places looks very different.
And just as you can't paint each city with one brush, you also can't generalize how nature responds to urbanization.
Urban evolution is a relatively new field, and it's really cool. For a long time, we kind of thought that evolution took millennia to happen, and it was a very slow process, and therefore organisms couldn't possibly keep up with the rate of urbanization that is occurring. And about a decade ago, researchers started to realize that urban animals can actually change really quickly. They can evolve really quickly, and a lot more quickly than we had ever thought.
Take, for instance, the Puerto Rican anole.
My friend Kristen's work, Dr. Kristen Winchell, her PhD research focused on the Puerto Rican anole. And she found that anole lizards in urban areas have stickier feet and longer limbs.
Both traits that help them in a city, to climb up slick surfaces like glass or painted concrete, or to run more easily between sparsely distributed trees.
Kristen found that these urban lizards repeatedly have these traits in different urban areas in Puerto Rico. And not only that, these traits have evolved multiple times.
Oh, wow.
Independently, because these selection pressures are so strong in these urban areas.
As far as what this all means for pigeons, Elizabeth is still working on her research. One question she wants to answer, it's kind of fun to think about, is, do pigeons flock in families?
Is a flock composed of aunts, uncles, cousins, grandma and grandpa?
But one of the most important things about pigeons might also be the thing that makes them feel so ordinary, that they live so close to us.
If they were to disappear from New York City, if they were to disappear from cities all over the world, I think we would be kind of sad. For a lot of us that live in cities, they're the only wildlife that we see on a daily basis. And therefore, there's this desire to interact with them because they provide some connection to the natural world. And the other great thing about pigeons is everybody has a story about a pigeon. So for my master's research, I worked on an animal called a giant elephant shrew, or giant sengi, which are found in sub-Saharan Africa. I have never seen one alive. I spent years working on this organism and have never seen one alive. And it was hard to get people to relate to that research because it's an animal that most people have never heard of and absolutely never seen.
Yeah.
But pigeons are one of these organisms that everybody has a story about. Everybody's had some interaction. And some of my favorite things have been talking to people and having them tell me, oh yeah, we had these two pigeons that were nesting on our AC unit. We called them Petey and Polly. And they have this whole story about kind of watching these pigeons for years on end. And so that makes me really happy. And it, again, is this way to connect to wildlife, which I think is this very innate desire that we have.
That was our producer, Justine Paradise, speaking with researcher Elizabeth Carlin. Before school closures from the coronavirus pandemic, science was the sort of subject where teachers could emphasize hands-on learning, away from screens. We at Outside In are all about hands-on, but trying to figure out how to keep that spirit alive through remote learning has been a challenge. A couple of weeks ago, NHPR's Sarah Gibson caught up with students and teachers who are discovering the limitations and the possibilities of science at home.
Dr. Sue Pike teaches science at the Dover Private School, St. Thomas Aquinas. One of the things she misses the most is seeing all her kids in a classroom peering into microscopes.
One of the favorites is like the pond water ones where we're looking at different species and then doing things with food webs. And they're all looking at microscopes and finding these disgusting worms and things that were in the pond. And people are talking to each other and sharing their ideas.
Sharing ideas in a lab is central to science education. Pike says it's nearly impossible to recreate that magic online.
We're all getting tired of like looking at a screen of faces, oftentimes with just the name, and it's just like talking into the void.
Most of Pike students don't have microscopes at home, but they can still go outside. And that's where some of the most engaging work happens. Recently, Pike asked her students to come up with a question about something they saw in their backyard. Freshman Rory Hatch asks if there's a certain part of his magnolia tree that blooms first, depending on the amount of sun it gets. So they talk it through on a class Zoom call.
So how could you do this? So you've got this tree. And I guess right now it has flowers, or you know that from past?
Well, last year it bloomed, but only two flowers bloomed, and they're on one part of the tree.
Most of these students say there's a perk to remote learning, more time outside. But advanced concepts in science and math classes are way harder to grasp now. Student Ryan Storm says he misses having a teacher look over his shoulder as he's doing calculations.
It's really hard to ask a teacher through like an email or even a video chat because it's like you can't do it with them.
This means teachers can't see in real time where students are getting confused, and that makes it harder to track progress. The story is a bit different for elementary school science. These lessons rely less on high-tech labs and more on simple materials that can often be found at home. April Marsh teaches at a public elementary school in Gorham. She recently assigned the Egg Drop Challenge.
So they were challenged to create some sort of device that would protect a raw egg when it was dropped from various heights.
Students loved it.
This is a lot funner.
Meet fourth grader Andrew Albert. He says all the screen time these days hurts his brain and eyes, but this assignment felt like an adventure.
So I was like thinking, I think I need to research something because I never done this before.
Eventually, Andrew found a solution. His sister helped him make a video for Mrs. Marsh. First, he cuts open a toy rubber ball.
Then I'm gonna put popcorn in it. This is gonna be hard.
Once it's full of popcorn, in goes the egg, which is wrapped in a sock.
For extra protection and so it doesn't explode.
Then he drops it from his deck and takes a video of the results.
And look at that. You got a fresh egg, not even hurt.
Later online, Marsh asks him to explain the physics of it, how energy got transferred, why the egg survived. As far as Marsh is concerned, that was a success. But she says managing expectations for remote learning is a balance.
You know, you give the material the best way that you can, and you hope that they retain the information, but with also the understanding that all of them are in very different environments in their house and have very different levels of support at home.
Take the mold terrarium. Recently, Marsh asked her class to leave a slice of bread in a plastic bag and watch it grow mold. Some told her, we don't have enough food at home. We can't let a slice of bread go to waste. Some families have found remote learning discouraging, but science educators say there are ways to make science fun, even if school at home feels like a drag. Gabby Brott is a coastal science educator with UNH Extension. She has three kids, 10, 8, and 4, and she says the only way they're getting through this is to immerse themselves in the woods.
We're calling them feral children at this point.
Going outside helps Brott and her kids release their pent-up energy, and it gives them a natural lab to poke around and ask questions. This reinforces a basic principle of science.
You ask a question, you try and find the answer. And it can be very simple. It's like, do you hear the birds? Do you hear that song? I wish I knew more about those songs.
The other day, the family used an iPad app to identify newly sprouted spring plants. They stopped, take the picture.
And let's see what it says. Dwarf cinquefoil.
Dwarf cinquefoil?
Yeah, and I think it's, it kind of looks like strawberry.
I think it's foil.
Cool.
With the app, Brot uses this little plant to introduce a big concept.
It tells you all of that it belongs to. This is called taxonomy. So it tells you it's from the kingdom Plantae.
When Brot's kids lose focus, they move on to something else. And Brot says that's okay. If you're trying to do home science, it should be short, hands-on, and built off of kids' curiosity in the moment. And if you're not a trained scientist, she says, don't sweat it. Just go outside and start asking questions.
That was NHPR's education reporter, Sarah Gibson. We were a little inspired by that piece, and we decided to add a new feature to our website with the help of my wife, an environmental educator and consultant whose business is called Inquire Ed. We've partnered episodes with standards from the Next Generation Science Standards for teachers or camp counselors who are looking for suggestions about how our shows can be used in the classroom. Check it out, outsideinradio.org, and look for curated lists. When we come back, we'll get a crash course on one of my favorite landscapes, the kettle bog. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. One of the things that I've become obsessed with while doing this job is the Pleistocene. That's the nerd name for the most recent ice age. In particular, I'm really taken with the late Pleistocene, the time in which the ice was melting back. And in its place came everything. Plants, animals, people. What if there were a way to see that time? To feel what it was like to live just past the edge of the ice.
So maybe you could just describe our surrounds here.
Yeah, so we're in a depression. A depression in the landscape of about 40 or 50 feet. And right here in the depression, it's fairly flat, kind of hummocky.
You're hearing Tom Lee. We've interviewed Tom before. He was a botanist at the University of New Hampshire who retired just a tiny bit before we recorded this. We took this walk on one of the few genuinely cold days in a distressingly warm New England winter.
What, about 15, 20 degrees?
It said 19 on my car.
19?
We're in one of the most unique places I've ever visited in New England. It's like a giant, nearly perfect circular bowl. Imagine one of those movies where the protagonists are walking around confused in some huge depression and the camera zooms back and you realize they're in some kind of giant dinosaur footprint. It's kind of like that.
Okay, now here we are in the center and you can really see the shape of this thing. And it almost looks like someone came in here with a bunch of excavators and dug out like an arena.
And almost a perfect circle, just a little bit more oval than a circle. It's remarkable. And of course, that was caused by, apparently, by a residual chunk of ice.
So get your deep time hat on, your deep time goggles. 15,000 years ago, this spot was covered with ice. Ice that's melting away, slowly, over thousands of years. Each year, this glacier the size of a continent was a little bit smaller. And as the edge of that ice gets to here, this spot, maybe like 8,000 years ago, something happens. Maybe an iceberg the size of a city block falls off and crashes to the ground below. It sits there for another, who knows, a couple hundred years, and sand and rocks and dirt, the detritus of the millenniums-long geological siege that the glaciers had been waging on the bedrock beneath them, piles up around the block of ice, like a donut.
It's likely the glacier continued to create outwash around this chunk of ice as it sat there. And then when the glacier was gone and the temperatures warmed, the ice melted and left a depression with a pool in the bottom.
Most water bodies, and maybe this sounds kind of dumb to observe, but most water bodies are formed by flowing water. But because of the unique origin story of this bog, it's got some unique properties. The only water flowing in comes from rain or melting snow, and there's nowhere for water to flow out, This results in a couple of things. The water is very low in nutrients, which leads to certain plants taking over, notably a thick mat of something called sphagnum moss, which stretches over the surface of the water.
In the summer when you're out here, you can literally bounce up and down on this thing. It's like a trampoline.
As a quick disclaimer, this is probably something that we should not be encouraging you to do because leave no trace and all that, and I actually would like to say that it's more like jumping on a waterbed than a trampoline, but it is true. The moss squelches and sags beneath you. The water seeps through and soaks you up to your shins. The moss grows slowly from the edges, covering the water, and in many bogs, there's an eye of open water in the middle.
Right around the eye is the floating mat. So if we dug down from where we're standing, we'd eventually come to free water.
Sphagnum was used as diapers by people throughout boreal regions and for binding wounds by ancient Gaelic and Irish warriors. But it's also the engineer of this ecosystem. To make use of what little nutrients there are in the water, it pumps out acid. The water in this bog has both the color and the acidity of coffee. This is why so-called bog bodies, people whose remains are found preserved in bogs, are so well preserved. The acidic water pickles them, like a big bog pickle. That acidity also means you get an unusual mix of plants in these bogs.
Members of the heath family, high bush blueberry, leatherleaf, bog rosemary, plants you don't really find commonly out there in the landscape. And there's some black spruce down here too. And those are plants that you find more commonly way up north, up in the boreal forest.
In spots like this, there's this lifting of the veil. It's one of those places where you can see geologic forces, except in real time. This is what it would have looked like as the Pleistocene ended, when the ice was still part of our collective memory, and when the mammoths were still roaming the New England steppe.
And so it's a very unique flora here. It's like stepping back into the Ice Age.
This is a mire, a muskeg, a moorland. This is a kettle bog. It's time now for another of our occasional series, 10 by 10, where we dive deep into places often overlooked. This time around, beneath the shrubs, the sedges, the rushes, and the moss of the bog, there's something else, peat. It's been piling up for millennia, but what happens to it in the next 100 years may well define our future. Today, we're going deep on peat.
We're here now at the Lefroy peat beds, a very special place for us, and what we do here, this is where we cut the peats to give us the flavour in the kilns when we flavour the malted barley.
What do you think of when you hear the word peat?
How do you cut peat? Well, you need to use tools like this here.
Now, this is you're like members of the Outside In team, you may think of scotch. Which is why producer Justine Paradise gathered us all for a little tasting session.
I can smell it like across the table.
Wow. Yeah.
And called up Karen Newman, the spirits editor of Wine Enthusiast magazine.
The thing is about scotch is that it's made only with just a very small handful of ingredients. It's made with barley, it's made with water, it's made with yeast, and that's it.
Thyme.
And thyme. Nice.
Barley, water, yeast, and thyme. But there's one more ingredient in some scotches that's allowed. Peat. Well, I mean, it's only sort of, but not even really an ingredient.
So the peat is dug up from peat bogs, and then it is, it's drained, it's put into a kiln, and the smoke is then allowed to flavor the barley. And then the barley later is fermented and distilled and miraculously retains the smoky flavor from the peat smoke.
But as any Scotch aficionado will tell you, and I have learned that we have at least two who work for our podcast, Jimmy and Erica.
Like if people order at a bar, they're getting 90%. Like the majority of what they're ordering is coming from Speyside.
Mm-hmm. MacAllen. That's
how Scotch. This is where bartender Jimmy's really coming out. Yes. I love this.
Oh, I love it.
Peat is a broad category.
If you go to Isla, for example, the flavor there, I mean, the tasting notes you get are things like seaweed and smoked bacon and smoked salmon and barbecue.
When I was at Glenfiddich, they described it as tastes and smells like gasoline. Just kind of
in a good way.
I was like, dare you.
Each region has its own kind of peat, its own peaty flavors, its own peatoir.
If you head a bit further north to Orkney, it's more wetland vegetation, and all that constant sea spray means that the plants don't really grow so well. And you wind up with a more herbaceous, pine-like, earthy flavor.
Does it taste like a wetland to you?
Campfire.
And then Lefroig.
Ooh, Lefroig Select. Mm-hmm.
Brooding.
Wow, my mouth is tingling.
Peppery.
Is this your best day at work ever?
Oh, wow. It was exciting buying all this.
This is perhaps how most people have interacted with peat. They know it in the abstract, a flavor. But if it's something that we're cutting and something we're burning, what is it?
And okay, just like one, to ask this once again in sort of brute layman's terms, What is peat?
Peat is dead, formerly living plant material.
That was Tom Lee again, and this is Ruth Varner.
We find peatlands in all climatic regimes, essentially. And what you really need is, you need a place that is wet.
Another researcher at the University of New Hampshire who studies peatlands, a colleague of Tom's.
And so what happens is when a system is saturated, the rates of decomposition of that organic matter that's there are really slow.
So low decomposition. Why? In a rushing, bubbling creek, the water has some oxygen, but bogs form in places where the water is just slowly seeping in from the rain. There's no inlet and no outlet.
Well, there's several things going on. One is that you do have still water. And as a result, oxygen tends to be depleted from the water by the plants and other organisms growing here and isn't recharged.
Most of the bacteria that decompose stuff use oxygen to break things down and produce carbon dioxide as a byproduct. But in a bog, they can't go to work. They don't have any fuel. So all these crumbling plant corpses, all this carbon-based material just piles up and up and up.
The rates of decomposition of that organic matter that's there are really slow. And so they're slower than the amount of organic matter that's being input to the system. And so you get an accumulation of carbon over time. And this is the time span we're thinking of is thousands and thousands of years.
Imagine, under your feet in a bog like this, layered dead plants might go down 1, 2, 3, even 4 stories, an inverted skyscraper of stored carbon.
And so over 10,000 years, there's been an accumulation here of at least 45 feet of peat. That's amazing. That's amazing.
And we're just standing in one particular bog, my personal favorite kind of bog, this kettle bog formed by a depression left by a big chunk of ice. But there are many different kinds of peatlands. Around here, in temperate regions,
where it's pretty dominated by mosses, so you're thinking about sphagnum moss, which you've probably may have used in gardening, added peat moss to your garden.
This is the peat that's flavoring your Scotch whiskey.
You gotta do a little wafting.
Gotta.
Oh yeah, she said the aroma is where a lot of, especially with the peaty ones, is where.
But there's also subtropical and tropical peat.
Peatlands in tropical systems are probably going to be more fibrous with remains of trees in them, so you're going to actually have, you know, large trees that might fall into a saturated system and then be part of that peatland. So if you, for example, took a core of peat from a tropical system, it's going to have a really different texture.
These also include mangrove swamps, which are one of the most effective ecosystems in the world when it comes to sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and are expanding thanks to climate change, according to one 2015 study. And of course, Arctic peat, which includes the infamous permafrost.
Permafrost is defined as ground that is permanently frozen for 2 years or more.
In all of these environments, there's a weird thing going on. Plants need nutrients to thrive, and peat is full of nutrients, but the plants, they can't get to it.
There's sort of an irony here. We have 45 feet in some places of peat.
Pure organic material.
Pure, with all kinds of nutrients in it, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, calcium, magnesium. It's not accessible to these plants and other organisms because the decomposers can't break this stuff down. And so, somewhat hilariously, all these plants are short of nutrients, and they're doing everything they can to kind of build up their nutrient levels. Many of them are evergreen. Keeping your leaves, not shedding them, is one way to conserve nutrients, especially nitrogen. But some of the plants here are carnivorous. We have purple pitcher plants here, as well as sundews. There's also bladderwort. These are three carnivores that live in this spot. And so they're adapted, essentially, to low-nutrient conditions, and carnivory enables them to, helps them survive in a place like this.
Most ecosystems accumulate carbon up to a point. Eventually, they reach a kind of equilibrium, a stage at which they're releasing as much as they're taking up. But bogs are different. Peatlands are, in essence, one route to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Lock it up in plants, and then when those plants die, lock it up underwater, and then with the passage of geologic time, lock it up in rock. But we've been focusing on peat formed in places like New Hampshire, places where the reason the peat stays peat is because it stays wet. But 80% of all of the carbon that's locked up in peat isn't there because it's wet, but because it's frozen. After a break, we'll talk about permafrost. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown.
So there's a signal that we're seeing from space, from satellites, in the Arctic, on the ground, and that's a sort of greening of these landscapes.
I want to introduce you to Isla Myers-Smith and her collaborator, Jeff Kirby. I interviewed them at the same time and remotely, which can be awkward.
Well, cool. Do you want to start?
Ahead. Sure, I'll just say something really briefly here.
They're both ecologists, Isla at the University of Edinburgh and Jeff at the Aarhus Institute of Advanced Studies in Denmark. So what scientists say is there's a lot of carbon stored in Arctic peat. How much?
The projection is that if a lot or most of that carbon was released from those permafrost soils, that would double the atmospheric CO2 concentration. So it is quite a lot of carbon, and there's still debate going on about exactly how much carbon that is.
I will repeat this fact because it is a whopper of a fact. If all of the carbon stored in permafrost were released, it would double the CO2 in the atmosphere. This is perhaps the most dreaded of all climate feedback loops. As the world gets warmer, the soil in the Arctic that usually stays frozen all year round starts to thaw. As it thaws, it starts to sink, subside. Riverbanks slump and mini landslides expose organic material that's been locked up in the ice for millennia to all of those little hungry microbes in the air that want to eat them up and turn them into carbon dioxide, which in turn makes the world warmer. Some people have called this the carbon bomb.
So there's a legitimate theoretical concern about this carbon bomb.
But, and I don't say this lightly, talking to Isla and Jeff made me realize the question of what the heck is going to happen in the Arctic as the world warms up and how fast is maybe one of the most complicated ones we've ever grappled with. And we're only, like, part way through grappling with it. For example, trees are starting to grow on the tundra where they never grew before, which trap more carbon, but might trap more snow, which might insulate the ground better in the winter, which might melt more permafrost, which might release all that carbon, but how long might that take?
Can I add another level of complexity here? Just to fully blow your mind.
Isla and Jeff study plants. They look at them in person, on the ground, using drone photography and using satellites.
But all of those measurements are just what's happening above the ground. And a lot of the really important questions about what's happening to carbon in this system are happening below the ground. And the below ground is just a black box at the moment, especially in tundra ecosystems.
So this question, what the heck is going to happen to all of that Arctic peat, all of that carbon that before we started monkeying around with the thermostat was going to just stay down there? It's probably the biggest known unknown in the world of climate change right now. Something that kind of blew my mind when reporting this, those global climate models that we've been using to try to get a glimpse of our future, most of them don't even model permafrost. When it comes to Arctic peat, the models just shrug.
That's just one of the challenges of dealing with nonlinear feedbacks, though. They're hard to study.
But here's another thing about peat. If you leave it alone, if we let it pile up, if we give it long enough, that kettle bog where we started out turns into something else. Maybe trees start to grow on top of the peat. Maybe a river changes course and buries it under sediment. Maybe tectonic plates drift, continents shift. The peat is folded, heated, compressed.
The organic matter that we're storing will, over, you know, many millions of years, become some kind of fossil fuel.
There was one particularly peaty time in the Earth's history, back before the dinosaurs, in the days of Pangaea, the days where there was much more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a much warmer, much wetter, much swampier time. It was called the Carboniferous Era, and that's when most of the Earth's coal was formed.
And so that carbon that accumulated there actually, yes, has become the coal that we use now.
So if you ever get a chance to tromp over a floating mat of sphagnum moss, stretched like a thin sheet over the bouncy waterbed of a partially frozen bog, just remember that beneath your feet is the source of our whole current climate predicament, as well as, arguably, one of its solutions, too. An ancient sink, an inverted skyscraper of carbon. We're going to keep the science going and answer one of your questions about the natural world. Every other week, I talk to NHPR's Morning Edition host, Rick Ganley, for a regular segment we call Ask Sam.
Why do geese make V's?
Does a bumblebee sneeze?
Can a person eat trees?
Can a polar bear freeze?
Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
Hey there, Sam.
Okay, today's question comes to us from Suzanne in Rumney.
And I've been going for a walk every morning since we've kind of been quarantined. So I've noticed lately that I've heard a lot of woodpeckers in the morning, and I haven't noticed them before. And I wondered if there were more of them or if this is the time of year that they are seeking out food from the trees. But it's all about woodpeckers.
We have a couple that live in our neighborhood, and we've been hearing them a lot more often, but they come around every spring, so I'm not sure if it's just an unusual year or we're just noticing them more.
There's actually a lot of reasons why Suzanne might be hearing more woodpeckers than ever, so we're just going to run through them like lightning round style.
Hold on, let me get my pencil. I'm going to score at home.
Okay. The first is seasonal, and Joan Walsh from Massachusetts Audubon explained this one to me.
This is when birds start to claim territories, and the way that woodpeckers claim territories is by talking a lot.
That, of course, was the pileated woodpecker. That's the big one.
That's the sound. That's the sound.
Okay. Second is because of your change of routine, perhaps you're going on a different kind of walk than you used to, and maybe you're just passing through like a more woodpeckery type of place. For instance, forests with more dead trees. But also, as Amanda Rodewald from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology explained to me, there's also a bird feeder effect here.
There have been a few studies that have found that their numbers are greater near feeders and in suburban areas that have a lot of bird feeders than other areas.
Yeah, there's a lot of feeders in my neighborhood.
Yeah. Okay, so that's two. Reason number three is that last year was a pretty good mast year. And Rick, so please apply your Ask Sam knowledge here. Tell the listeners, what is a mast year?
That's when we have an overabundance of acorns and nuts and things like that.
Bing, 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 bing.
So it might have been this last fall and winter. It was a really stellar year for acorns or other nuts that the woodpeckers like.
I've learned something. See, I pay attention.
It's not a lost cause.
Well.
So that's driving all our short-term changes, the year-to-year up and down in woodpecker numbers. The last two reasons are the ones that I think are most interesting, though they might not be the reason why our caller is noticing more changes this particular spring. The first is a general trend in New England, and that's that the region has been reforesting for a couple of generations now. And not only that, our existing forests have been getting older, which means...
That very large woodpeckers, like pileated, can now find a suitable nest nest tree in places that 40 years ago, just the trees just weren't big enough.
So is this part of a trend, Sam? We're going to see more woodpeckers as the years go on?
Well, certainly it's been the trend so far. You know, all those bigger trees are, of course, also full of bugs to eat. And if you look at the big multi-decade data sets, so there's the USGS Breeding Bird Survey, there's Audubon's Christmas Bird Count, and they all show rising populations of all sorts of woodpeckers just because there's more wood to peck.
More snag trees.
Yeah, exactly. Big old dead trees that get old enough to die. And then that brings us, of course, to our last reason, which is one that foresters are worried about and tell me about all the time, which is that we've got more forest pests than ever, including invasive ones. And an example, of course, is the emerald ash borer, which has been killing huge quantities of ash trees all throughout the Midwest and Northeast.
And so there have been a few studies that have found in locations that have had high mortality of ash trees due to this emerald ash borer, you do in fact see greater numbers of many woodpeckers.
That was me and NHPR's Morning Edition host, Rick Ganley. We had some beautiful weather this week, which means it's time for us to transition to our regular downer segment this May, tick season.
It's tick, tick, tick-tock season.
This month, Taylor Quimby, our producer and host of our spin-off podcast, Patient Zero, is bringing us straightforward advice on tick-borne disease. Today, what to do if you get bit.
If you find a tick burrowed into your skin, the very first thing you should do is panic. I'm kidding. There are three things to remind yourself when you've been bitten. Not all species of ticks carry Lyme disease. Of the species that do, not all of them are infected. And even when they are, diseases take time to transmit. So step one is not to freak out, it's
remove that tick as quickly as possible.
This is Eric Foster, a medical entomologist with the CDC.
We don't recommend that, you know, people use a match or cover it with petroleum jelly or anything like that.
Use tweezers.
Do it as fast as possible and pull it straight out. No twisting, no freak out moments.
Again, with the don't freak out message, this is Caitlin Morse, a doctor of infectious disease and executive director of Bebop Labs, a nonprofit that's tracking infected ticks in New Hampshire. If step one is to remove the tick, then step two is definitely to identify it. And that's why it's important to know your area's ticks.
If there's any white on them, you found a dog tick. If there's any red on them, then you found a black-legged tick, although that's only the female, but female.
Here in New Hampshire, the vast majority of ticks are either dog ticks or the ones you really don't want, black-legged ticks, also known as deer ticks.
The problem is if they are the nymphs, which are so tiny, they really don't have a lot of identifying features.
Maria Duke-Wasser there, disease ecologist at Columbia University.
In fact, we have an app called the Tick App that it can do just that. So you can take a picture and send it to us and we tell you which tick it is and how long we think it might have been on you.
So second point, even if you pull out a black-legged tick, it's very, very unlikely you've contracted something like Lyme disease unless it's been embedded for 24 hours or more. The problem is, well, it's hard to know how long the tick has been in there. They're small.
The size of a poppy seed, which is not trivial.
The folks behind the tick app can estimate with a photo, or you can take the next step and get your tick tested. Ticknology and Tick Report are two commercial labs where, for somewhere between $25 and $50, you can get a full workup on your tick. They'll identify the species, tell you whether it's fed or partially fed, and maybe most importantly, tell you if it's infected with disease.
If it's a black-legged tick and I don't know how long it's been on me, then I'm like, okay, this is one that I'm definitely gonna get tested.
Most of the time, a tick bite does not by itself warrant a dose of antibiotics. That's the normal treatment when a doctor suspects you may have Lyme disease. Some doctors will give you a prophylactic dose of antibiotics for a tick bite.
Others will tell you to wait and see.
The CDC only recommends prophylactic antibiotics for black-legged tick bites where the tick has been embedded for over 36 hours, and only then in Lyme endemic counties and states like New Hampshire. For short-duration bites, the low risk of infection isn't necessarily worth the side effects of the medicine. But even if the risk isn't high enough for a preemptive strike, it is wise to remain vigilant.
Save that tick and watch for symptoms.
Again, this is Eric Foster from the CDC.
Keep an eye out for fever and body aches, any kind of joint pains, any rash.
And if you get any of those symptoms or more over the next few weeks,
see your healthcare provider immediately.
This episode of Outside In was produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Justine Paradise, and Taylor Quimby. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of staff, Tick Checks. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder, additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Outside In is hosting a virtual trivia night at the end of next week. By the way, donations to the show in any amount will get you a ticket. There's more information at our website, outsideinradio.org, and we hope to see you there. Prepare to be stumped by our awesome nature facts. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.